This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. In newspapers and magazines, on radio, television, and the internet, come messages telling us to eat this, not that, to take these supplements, to avoid doing this or that. How do you sort the good information from the bad? We'll put that question this afternoon to our guest, Robert Davis. He's an award-winning health journalist who holds a PhD in health policy from Brandeis University. Robert Davis is also the author of The Healthy Skeptic, Cutting Through the Hype About Your Health. In the book, Davis takes on the information that's put before us as factual. He says often these so-called facts are misleading or oversimplified, promoted by interest groups with a stake in the food industry, pharmaceutical industry, dietary supplement industry, or in the business of weight loss. Also up for some criticism from Davis are some consumer activists who, in his words, cause undue alarm over dangers from chemicals and distort our health priorities. At the same time, he says, quoting again, we have to be careful not to fall prey to cynicism, the belief that all health promoters are either liars or fools and that we shouldn't listen to any of them. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Robert Davis. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Robert Davis was the executive producer of the PBS series Health Week. His work has also appeared on CNN and WebMD and in the Wall Street Journal. He also teaches at Emory University's Rollins School of Public Health. The Healthy Skeptic, Cutting Through the Hype About Your Health, is published by the University of California Press. Listeners, I look forward to your questions for our guest, Robert Davis. You can join us with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Robert Davis, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks, Celeste. Great to be with you.
What does it mean to be a healthy health skeptic?
A healthy skeptic is somebody, I think, who takes time to critically evaluate all information, regardless of where it comes from, regardless of whether it comes from a pharmaceutical company, a health group, a government agency, a celebrity, or anybody else, to look not only at the information but also at the source of the information and to think about what motives that source may have for distorting the information in some way.
Yeah. Would you give us an idea of the ideas that you've come across as a health journalist that have been sound and some that have not been so sound?
Well, certainly, and I discuss this in the book, there are things that we hear about that are beyond question when it comes to our health. It's clear that smoking is bad for us, that you shouldn't smoke. It's clear that exercise is good for us, that good for us in a number of different ways, and that's been established through many years of clinical trials and other kinds of studies. And so those are two things that we can be certain are true. It appears that eating a healthful diet can be very beneficial. Now, of course, there's controversy as to what exactly constitutes a healthful diet, but I think that the evidence is fairly clear that that does include it includes low in saturated fat, high in fiber, and other elements of a healthful diet we hear about. As far as things that are not true, that's a very long list, and so there are a number of things that I have reported on over the years. We see just recently, for example, in the news, and we could spend the entire time talking about things that are not true, but just one recent example is vitamins. We hear all the time about claims that certain vitamins are good for us and we should take larger doses, but just in the last couple of weeks, for example, we've seen more clinical trials showing that high doses of, or that I should say just taking vitamin E and vitamin C do not have the benefits that have been claimed in the past with regard to heart disease and cancer. So I think that there are all kinds of areas where we see information that's distorted or not quite as it appears.
Yeah. Vitamins, and a moment ago you mentioned celebrities. Dr. Andrew Weil, I was so disappointed to read that in your book, to read about his role in selling vitamins today. And I actually went to his website, and sure enough.
Right. And I think that's disappointing to a number of people, and he's received a great deal of criticism for it. I mean, my view on Dr. Weil is he is, in general, a voice of moderation and reason when it comes to alternative therapies. You know, sometimes the great difficulty in knowing what to believe when in terms of alternative therapies is that those who advocate them often are on the fringe scientifically. Dr. Weil, however, is the mainstream. He looks to mainstream research when it comes to supplements, dietary supplements, and other alternative therapies. Unfortunately, however, he's chosen to put his name on vitamins to sell them. He has a site that does so. Now, he will tell you, which is true, that he doesn't make money for himself. He makes it for his foundation, which funds research on alternative therapies. But as I say in the book, that's really beside the point. The point is that he is profiting in some way. The money is going toward interests of his. And so that's something that we need to be wary of when it comes to his recommendations on his website for particular vitamins that he sells.
Yeah. Well, you're a healthy, entering middle-aged guy who exercises regularly and eats a healthful diet. And you took the questionnaire, you filled out the questionnaire, the vitamin advisor, and I was shocked to see what was recommended for you. Some vitamins and minerals that are more than 100% of the recommended daily values.
Right, and that on top of that would cost me many hundreds of dollars a year when I could, according to the science, do just as well taking a multivitamin for $30 a year. So I think there's the problem that that a number of vitamins that he's recommending not only are more than we need. For example, he recommends huge doses of vitamin C on the website, that we purchased large doses of vitamin C that exceed even his recommendations, but then there's the cost of these vitamins, and I think that people need to be wary that they're not only wasting money, but also perhaps taking, in some cases, levels of certain vitamins that may be harmful.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Robert Davis, author of The Healthy Skeptic, Cutting Through the Hype About Your Health. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455. So that's 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now. A listener on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I was just curious. Of course, I caught the beginning, so I didn't get to hear the part about Dr. Anthony Weil, or Weil, however you say his name. I had read a couple of books of his. One was 8 Weeks to Optimum Health, and I haven't had a chance to read your book yet, which I didn't catch the name. I'd like to hear the name again.
Okay.
And second, I guess I'm kind of a person who is in recovery, have been for quite a while, and one of the things I do is in anything that I pick up and read and anything that I take a close look at as far as my health is concerned, I try to just take the stuff that I need and leave the rest of it alone. There's certainly things that I think makes good common sense to do, like in 8 Weeks of Optimum Health, he talks about some of the easiest things being putting simple things into your diet, like I believe garlic, olive oil, and certain types of olive oil, of course.
Fatty fish and lots of veggies.
Yeah. And then breathing was a big thing. It's not something you have to go out and spend money on. Making use of a sauna to sweat out toxins, And I do know that he sells and promotes his own line of stuff, basically, but I have no interest in utilizing that. So that's one of the things that I didn't get from his, you know, writings in his book. But what I did get was these other things that felt very, very, you know, useful. And I think that that's something that people have to do when they start researching and looking into this sort of thing is, you know, don't use things that just don't make common sense. You know, try to use the things that make decent sense to you, that sound like good sound advice. And yeah, research, check, you know, double check and triple check on different things, you know, through the web and the library and
sounds like you're a healthy skeptic.
Well, I wish I were healthier. You know, I'm working on it, but that's just part of the deal, you know. So,
well, thanks for the call, and let's Robert Davis.
Right. One thing, Celeste, I would say, the caller makes a good point about using common sense, because the way that I would put it is that if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. You know, if you go to the bookstore, the shelves are lined with all kinds of miracle breakthroughs, books that promise that you can get thinner in a few weeks, that promise you can follow some kind of magical formula and get healthy. And we, unfortunately, keep falling for these things, and it's important that we keep reminding ourselves that there are no secrets. There are no magical formulas. There are no magic bullets. Unfortunately, I wish there were, but there aren't, and so it requires doing things that are in accordance with common sense, as the caller says.
Okay, and for that caller, let me share with him and the rest of our audience the title of Robert Davis's book. It is The Healthy Skeptic, Cutting Through the Hype About Your Health. The Healthy Skeptic, the publisher, is the University of California Press. Let's take another call now. Next, listener in Champaign, line two. Hi.
Hi, thanks so much for having Robert Davis on. I'm going to ask a couple of quick questions, and I'm just going to hang up and listen. Would you please address the importance of the use of various fish oils? How valid is that suggestion, especially with respect to arthritis? And would you also address the possible use of small amounts daily of such anti-inflammatory spices as ginger and turmeric and that sort of thing? Thanks a lot. I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Well, the answer to the first question is that, in fact, there is a good deal of research that's fairly solid when it comes to fish oils. And, in fact, this is one area of alternative medicine supplements where I think the evidence is particularly strong. There have been studies showing that about a gram a day can be beneficial when it comes to heart disease, and there are also studies showing that other conditions, perhaps in depression and others, can benefit. There can be benefits with regard to fish oil. So I think the evidence there is pretty decent. Now, when it comes to the type of fish oil you use, and I discussed this in the book, there are resources I mentioned in the book, places to go to help find brands that are actually have what they say on the label. You know, Celeste, sometimes people don't realize when it comes to these supplements, dietary supplements, there aren't the kind of regulations in place that there are for, say, prescription drugs. And so there's no guarantee that they have the potency or purity that you would expect. And so that's why groups like ConsumerLab.com, and I mentioned this, I discussed this group in the book, ConsumerLab.com is a good place to go if you're trying to find a particular brand of fish oil supplements to try to see if, to make sure that that product has what it says on the label.
Okay.
So that's something important to keep in mind when you're buying any kind of vitamin or mineral or herb. Now, with regard to spices, I think the evidence here is not as quite as strong. I think you've got claims that are made. I think that the evidence that I have seen, at least, is not very compelling when it comes to spices having the kinds of power against, say, arthritis. I may not be aware of some of the evidence the caller knows about, but again, in my reporting, I haven't seen anything that I find convincing.
Okay, let's take another call. A listener on a cell phone in Urbana, line three. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I was calling. I was wanting to see if the author has researched essential oils. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, essential oils. Are they? Is there any validity to all the claims of being able to cure anything from a head cold to cancer?
Again, I would put it in the same category as spices. I have not seen any evidence that I find compelling for that to be the case.
Okay, because my girlfriend spends a lot of money every month on buying, you know, clove and lemon and just every kind of oil you can think of. And, of no studies that show any use for them.
Well, again, there are studies. The question is how compelling the evidence is. Now, in some cases, one could argue that, the lack of evidence doesn't mean that the things don't work. It may mean that there just hasn't been enough evidence to show that they work. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we have to go. We have what we have. I mean, the best we have is the scientific process. That's how we separate truth from fiction. And so the evidence to date would suggest that that there's not a reason to use them. However, let me say that if you want, and again, I list in the book several different sources. When you have questions like this, you can check. One is the Mayo Clinic has a database of various herbs and other kinds of alternative remedies, dietary supplements, and they actually rate the evidence, and they will list the kinds of studies that have been done and give it a grade from A to F in terms of the quality, the strength of that evidence. And I find that to be very helpful because you're able to make more informed judgments if you can say, okay, here are the studies that have been done. It's rather weak evidence or it's strong evidence to be able to make a judgment based on the facts rather than just guessing.
Okay, so the Mayo Clinic, yeah, the thing that, you know, she gets a lot of information from Young Living, and, you know, the guy, I think his name is Tony something. Anyway, I mean, he's hawking the stuff, as you had kind of indicated about Dr. Wiles, which it sounds like a little bit different situation, but, I mean, he's hawking the stuff. He's having all these seminars. He's bringing people into a pyramid scheme to sell the oils. It's all about money.
Right, and I think any time you have somebody who's hawking a product, that should raise a red flag.
All right, well, thank you very much for your time. I'm going to look for your book and check out this. Was consumerlabs.com?
Consumerlab.com is one, right, and there are others in the book, and the Mayo Clinic is another good source as well.
Okay, all right, I will look at those, and I'm going to look for your book. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. Good luck to you.
All right.
And next we go to Chicago, a listener on line 4. Hello.
Thank you. I was going to ask some items that you already answered, but I have alternative ones, and that would apply to aromatherapy using herbs and oils, and then what you thought of homeopathy, and then after that, I have one or two items. Could you comment on aromatherapy and homeopathy?
Aromatherapy, I sound like a naysayer here, I don't see a lot of evidence. I certainly think, what I've seen is that it can make a difference in maybe perhaps making people feel better in terms of increasing their sense of well-being, but in terms of having any real therapeutic effects, and I know it's been put to the test, I haven't seen any evidence that it can have those benefits.
And homeopathy?
Same with that. I think that homeopathy, the theory behind that is that very small amounts, tiny amounts, can have therapeutic effects if in fact a poison or something that's bad for you can actually have the opposite effect, can be therapeutic. And I think, again, I have not seen any kind of evidence at all. This theory's been around for a long time. And matter of fact, I think that to a large extent, the theory's been discredited that homeopathic remedies can be effective. Now, I know there are a lot of people that believe in them, that swear by them. And let me just, say one other thing, that sometimes you find that products on the market are labeled as homeopathic, and the reason they're labeled as homeopathic is that these products actually have an exception. They can make claims that others can't because of the way the law is written, because essentially they were grandfathered in. And so what some cold remedies and others end up doing is labeling their products as homeopathic because they can make more claims and get away with it than if they were not homeopathic. And again, that's due to a loophole in the law that gives special privileges to homeopathic remedies. So sometimes you'll see things that are labeled as homeopathic And they're simply labeled that way so that the manufacturers can get away with making more claims. But in general, the answer is that I have not seen evidence. I am not aware of evidence that homeopathic remedies are effective. Mm.
That's interesting, although some people have used it, find benefit, unless they may be getting a placebo effect or something. But some people have found effectiveness, just like in the area of magnetism, that certain magnets have an effect on certain conditions, like if you burnt your finger and use a magnet in a proper manner or a toothache, it does have a palliative effect and a soothing, sometimes even reversing the condition. But areas that go on from there would be like cosmetics. They're talking about using vitamins in the cosmetics, everything from A, B, C, E, and onward, you know.
Right. And again, I think that's more of a marketing gimmick than it is anything that's based in science. I guess let me just make one point here about individuals finding that various remedies work. I think, and I don't question their sincerity. I don't question what they're saying. I think that it's quite possible that people try things and they do work, and that's why they swear by it, whether it's magnets or whether it's homeopathy. But I guess the point I would make is that what separates us from people who lived 100 years, 200 years ago, is that we have science. We have modern scientific studies that can separate truth from fiction. And in the past, people had to rely on anecdotal experiences. They had to rely on, well, this worked for me, it worked for my friend, so this therefore must be a good thing. And today, we have a system in place. It's not perfect, but it is a system for being able to really get closer to the truth. And so I think that we have to pay heed to what the science tells us and not completely dismiss it and say, well, I know that it works because it works for somebody else, so therefore the science must be wrong. So my message that I repeat in the book is the importance of looking to the science, of looking to the studies, and I discuss ways to go find these things out. You don't have to be a researcher. You don't have to be a doctor. There are places you can go to really learn about what the science says, and then you can make a more informed judgment.
Okay, I want to thank the listener for his call. And next, we're going to take a call from a listener in Mackinac. Line one, hi.
Hi. This was just a fascinating discussion. I'm enjoying it very much. I'd like to go back and just make one comment about the essential oils. We have to keep it. Essential refers to essence of, so essence of clove, essence of rose, essence of whatever, and it doesn't mean that it's essential to the human being.
That's a good point.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. And next we're going to take a call for Robert Davis from a listener in Urbana, line two. Good afternoon.
Yes. Hi, I just have a quick question. Somebody asked about different types of usages of things. I used to use arnica a lot, arnica gel for muscle aches and knee joint aches, stuff like that, after either bicycling or doing, you know, some sort of rigorous exercise. But then I read maybe 2-3 years ago that arnica is generally a toxin or toxic form of something. I don't remember the whole thing exactly, but that is recommended not to be used at all. So do you know anything about arnica at all?
Unfortunately, I do not. You've stumped me on this one, and actually you've given me something new to go find out about and write about. So thank you. But unfortunately, I'm sorry that I can't shed any light on that. But I certainly can find out, and we'll be looking into it in the future.
Okay, they actually sell a tube form of gel that you can use to spread on muscles and joints. So, just curious.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
No lack of material for you, right, Robert?
I never get bored with this, and there's always something new to look into.
Yeah. Robert Davis is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of The Healthy Skeptic, Cutting Through the Hype About Your Health. He's an award-winning health journalist. He also holds a PhD in health policy from Brandeis, and he teaches at Emory University's Rollins School of Public Health. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions for Robert Davis. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. One of the chapters that I found fascinating in The Healthy Skeptic was the look at superfoods. And we have been really sold on this idea. When did this concept arrive on the scene, and are there superfoods?
Well, it arrived on the scene, I'd say, during the last 10 years or so. Particularly, it's become a big industry. We have several books that have come out that tout this idea that there are certain foods that have ingredients that can ward off cancer and heart disease and other conditions, and that we should eat more of specific foods. I think my view on superfoods is that it is really a misleading concept. I think what this causes us to believe is that specific foods, when eaten in isolation, can have magical powers to ward off disease, whether those foods are tomatoes or watermelon or blueberries or milk or walnuts, whatever. The dark chocolate is another one I talk about. And it's tempting to believe that if we eat more dark chocolate or eat more blueberries, we'll be healthier. But the truth, if you look at the science, that it's not about the specific foods we eat. It's about our overall dietary patterns. The truth is that our diet does matter. It can matter a great deal in terms of our overall health. But it's the totality of our diet, our overall diet eating patterns that matter. It's not whether we have one food or another. Now, clearly, some foods are better than others. Broccoli is better than Twinkies. So that's not to say that all foods are good or all foods are bad, but it is to say that and the choices we make are important. But I think we need to avoid getting caught up in this mindset that I must eat blueberries, I must eat this food, I must eat that food, because I think the whole concept of taking something as complex as our diet, of the numerous ingredients these foods contain and the way that they interact in our bodies in very complex ways, and boil it down to if you eat a specific food, it'll have a specific effect on your risk for disease. It almost defies common sense. And yeah. So I think that we need to be careful when we hear these kinds of claims.
Yeah. Although I love blueberries. In fact, my husband jokes I was a bear in a past life.
So, well, and they're, I do too, and they're good to eat and they're fine to eat. It's just that I worry that people become obsessed with blueberries.
Yeah, forego a healthy diet, forego a variety of foods just to bulk up on one thing in particular, the superfood of the moment. Is that part of it, that it's just too boring to eat a variety of foods?
I think that's it, and I think that also we're looking for quick fixes. That's just the way we are. And we'd like to think that if we eat hamburgers and french fries a lot, or we eat an otherwise unhealthy diet, we throw some blueberries in, we put some blueberries on our ice cream.
And a big chocolate bar.
Right. Then that'll make us healthier. And so I think that's part of it. We're looking for some easy, quick way to be healthier.
Yeah. Let's take another call now, a listener in Champaign. On line one, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question about something that's touted as a quick fix, and maybe there's some skepticism about it now, and that's statins for cholesterol. Some of the nutritionists, I'm aware of some work, particularly at the University of Illinois, suggest that cholesterol really isn't a problem. Some kinds of fats are a problem, but not cholesterol. And I went some of the research that suggested that cholesterol is the issue has been in the interest of drug companies, and some other research has been underemphasized. I wonder what your guest has to say about that.
Okay, he's got a chapter on that.
Right. Well, my answer to that is that you're right that there are actually a whole community of cholesterol skeptics who say that cholesterol is not really a risk factor for heart disease, and that we need to ignore the information that we're hearing about cholesterol. I take a more sort of moderate view. I'm frankly a bit skeptical of the skeptics in this case. I think that they're a bit extreme. However, I do believe that the whole idea of cholesterol as a risk factor has been exaggerated, and I discuss this in the book. I think it's been exaggerated in several ways. First of all, we hear all the time that cholesterol is perhaps the most important thing, if not the most important thing, in determining our risk for heart attacks. And yet, if you look at the evidence, half the people who have heart attacks have normal or low cholesterol levels. So that should suggest to us that cholesterol is not the end-all, be-all when it comes to heart disease, that there are a number of contributors, and cholesterol is just one of them. So I think the first thing to keep in mind is that we shouldn't fixate on our cholesterol score. You know, I discuss in the book ways, and sometimes people that are very healthy that have little reason to be concerned about their health may end up having high cholesterol, and they end up being worrywarts because of their high cholesterol. and they don't need to be. On the other hand, you have people that are at high risk for heart disease because of their lifestyles, because they smoke, because they have high blood pressure, because they don't exercise, and they have normal or low cholesterol, and they say, well, I don't have to worry about it. I have low cholesterol. So I think the point here is that it is dangerous to put greater weight on the cholesterol score than is really warranted. So that's my take on cholesterol. As for the medications that are used to treat it, the statins, here again, I think that there should be some concern about how we're using these medications. Clearly, for people who have had heart disease, who have a history of heart disease, the medications have been shown to be effective in reducing the risk of another heart attack and reducing the risk of further heart disease, and that's pretty clear. I think what's far less clear is their effectiveness in people who do not have a history of heart disease, people who are free of heart disease, so-called primary prevention. In this case, the studies show that men who do not have middle-aged men particularly, who do not have a risk or who do not have a history of heart disease, may benefit somewhat in terms of preventing heart disease, but the benefit is relatively small. However, women, there's no direct evidence, surprisingly, that statins can benefit women who do not have a history of heart disease, nor is there strong evidence when it comes to the elderly, people over, say, 70 or 75, for those individuals benefiting. Now, that's not something we hear. It's not something that's made clear to us. We hear, you know, statins ought to be put in the water. Everybody should be taking statins. And so we need to be mindful of that. And when you're confronted with the option of taking a statin, I think it's important to ask a doctor or to look for yourself, what is the evidence in someone like me, someone of my, with my health history, someone of my age, my gender, that these drugs can be beneficial, are beneficial in someone like me? And let me just say one other thing, Celeste. There is also the reason we have to ask that is there are downsides to these drugs. You know, no drug is free of side effects. And like any other drugs, these drugs do have side effects. There are potential muscle problems. There are liver problems potentially. There even in some cases, there have been reports of memory problems. And so I think that's why, like any drug, they have side effects. And so we need to be very careful about knowing what the benefits are so those can be weighed against any possible side effects.
Mm. Does a listener want to follow up?
No, I think that was very helpful. Thank you.
Very thorough answer. Okay, let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line two. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. I was very pleased to hear what the previous caller had to say and the guest's response to it. Earlier in the program, all the questions had been about what some people would call the marginal people connected with health and health advice. But the information that we need to be skeptical about also must include what comes from mainstream medicine. I'll mention a couple examples and then I'll ask a question. Almost anywhere you go, you will be told that women over a certain age should have a mammogram every year or two. But from what I'm able to gather in the research community, it's actually very controversial even to this day. Another thing is a lot of major surgical operations that have been around for decades had never really been studied and validated. And people recently had begun to look at some of them, like open heart surgery and angioplasty and so forth, and discovered that, in fact, for most people, probably it's not a good idea. And then the thing I have a question about, with respect to vitamin D, the official information is that people under 50 should get 200 IU a day, and over 50 should get 400, and over 70 should get 600. But there seems to be an awful lot of research literature that suggests that people should get a lot more vitamin D than that. And I'm interested in what your viewpoint is on that.
Okay.
Well, let me just respond generally to the caller's point about being skeptical of conventional medicine. I think he makes an excellent point, and I say that we need to be equal opportunity skeptics, that we need to be skeptical not only of things that are considered alternative or complementary, but also of, as the caller suggests, mainstream treatments and techniques, because he's exactly right that there are a number of treatments that are used in conventional medicine that, in fact, are not proven, that have not been subjected to strenuous research. And so I think that we need to be careful there and apply the same scrutiny, the same skepticism to all treatments, regardless of who offers them. With regard to vitamin D, the caller is right on that. There has been considerable talk about the fact that the vitamin D recommendations need to be raised, and I think that evidence is emerging. It's not completely conclusive yet, but I think there's a growing consensus among those who look seriously at the evidence to show that the recommendations for vitamin D should be raised. I think there's a concern that people, a good segment of the population, has a vitamin D deficiency, and there are a growing amount of evidence suggesting that this may be linked to cancer and other conditions, and that we perhaps do need more vitamin D than we're often getting.
Okay, and thoughts here on, I think recently the recommendation was boosted. I don't know where it is at the moment, to tell you the truth. How much higher are they thinking it should go?
You know,
authorities.
Right. I think that the answer is that's not clear. I don't know. I can't answer that exactly, but I do know that in some cases it's been suggested it might be doubled. Now, one thing to keep in mind is the easiest way to get sufficient vitamin D is to spend time in the sun, because our skin produces vitamin D by exposure to the sun. So that's actually the best way to get vitamin D, and this leads into a discussion which we can have about the role of the sun. We're told all the time to avoid the sun because exposure to the sun can lead to skin cancer, which is true, but at the same time there are benefits to exposure to the sun, at least in small amounts. I'm not saying to go bask in the sun all day, but short spurts of exposure to the sun can in fact be beneficial, because they help our bodies produce vitamin D. Now, in terms of, again, the amount we need, it's, I think, right now somewhere between 200 and 600 IUs, and I think that I've read in some cases that people say we need 800 or more a day, and so the sun is the best way to get lots of vitamin D.
Okay. I want to thank the listener for his call. Let's go and take a call from a listener on line 3 who's waiting on a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is an excellent program. I would like for you to address two areas. One is glucosamine, and then, of course, the headings under that would be glucosamine chondroitin. And then I've also seen now glucosamine sulfate, and if you recommend them for, say, things like osteoarthritis, or if not, how much. And the other item would be the calcium supplements. Many of them are calcium carbonate, of which I've been told that only a small percentage is absorbed for various reasons, but if you use the calcium citrate, then that doesn't require acid at the food, and therefore is more readily absorbable and better tolerated, causing fewer GI disturbance.
Okay. Well, let me take each of those. Glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate, those have been touted as treatments for arthritis, joint pain. The evidence here has been mixed, and I know there are lots of people and doctors even who swear by these supplements, these dietary supplements, for their arthritis patients, and a number of people with arthritis take them religiously. The early evidence, the initial evidence, looked pretty promising that these supplements could in fact be beneficial. We've had trials recently, however, that have been disappointing, that have shown that they do not live up to their promise. I think I don't think that the evidence is in to say they absolutely do not work, but I do think there's reason for doubt. Now, for people who are taking them who find that they're helpful, there's no evidence of harm that have come from these trials. And again, these have been, there's lots of research going on about these supplements. But I would say, based on what I have seen, that the evidence is mixed with regard to these. With regard to specific ones, again, I think a place like Consumer Lab is a good place to go to look at specific products, and also to get a better sense of what dosage of those particular products is recommended. Calcium. Calcium, there's the caller's right, there's calcium citrate, calcium carbonate, different forms of calcium. I think that again, research has been done on both forms, and I don't think there's a definitive answer as to which is better. I think most studies suggest that either is fine. They do have to be taken. Calcium citrate, I believe, as the caller said, can be taken with or without food. Whereas calcium carbonate is different. So I think that there are different kinds of requirements in terms of how you take the calcium, but with regard, and there are different opinions as to which one is more effective. But I, again, as far as I can tell, I don't think there's any firm evidence one way or the other that one is good and or better than the other.
Okay. I want to thank the listener for a call, and are going to keep things moving here because we've got another couple of folks here waiting and we're drawn down on time. Listener on line one, you're on the air with Robert Davis. Hi.
Hi. I had a question about arthritis things, and glucosamine chondroitin was sort of one of them that you've already covered, but are there any supplements that you think are good for arthritis? I'm currently taking alfalfa and tart cherry and what's the other thing? Oh, can't think of it. But at any rate, are there other supplements that you think would be worthwhile for arthritis, or is there just nothing out there that you think is...
Unfortunately, nothing that I've seen that has that there's compelling evidence for. There's one called SAMe, S-E-M-E. There's been some evidence on that. It's very expensive, and the evidence, I don't think, has been completely positive on that, but you might look at that and look at the evidence on that. But I'm not aware of any others for which there's compelling evidence.
Oh, yogurt's the other thing that I read
yogurt.
In Science News, they had an article about yogurt being helpful for arthritis. So I started taking eating yogurt every day, and I don't know if it's
coincidence. Has it helped?
But it seems to, yeah. And if, I know if I skip it a couple of days, then it gets more painful.
Well, there might be other benefits to yogurt as well, mm-hmm. So we just keep eating it then.
Yeah, yogurt's good in general for everything, so.
Right.
But there's nothing that you...
Nothing that I'm aware of, okay. Unfortunately.
Darn.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Listener on line two in Champaign. Hello?
Oh, hello?
Hi.
Hi, a wonderful show that you're having, and I have two quick questions. Lipoflavonoid for tinnitus. And what is your vitamin regimen that you?
The first one I do not have an answer for you. That's not something that I've researched. Again, I'll have to add that to my list of things to look into. So thank you for the suggestion. My vitamin regimen is that I take a multivitamin, a basic multivitamin. I steer clear of vitamins that are specially targeted toward, you know, different populations, men, women, teachers. They have some for teachers even. So I'm leery of those, but a basic multivitamin, and I do not take vitamins in addition to that because, again, I have not seen evidence that vitamins above and beyond a multivitamin are beneficial.
What about ginkgo, Bill?
Ginkgo, actually, there have been, you know, claims that it can help with memory. There was just a study that came out this week, a large study, one of the largest, if not the largest to date, that was published in a major medical journal. Again, it was disappointing, showing that it did not, it was not beneficial. And so that's been disappointing because I know a lot of folks were hoping that ginkgo could help, particularly with memory issues. But so far, unfortunately, the evidence has not been been that reassuring.
Okay, thanks. Great show. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Targeted to teachers?
Just about every group seems
wow.
to have its own multivitamin now.
Wow, hokey smokes, Bullwinkle. I can see targeting vitamin formulas for children and perhaps age groups. But you and what do you think about that? But you say I don't take a targeted multivitamin.
Well, the problem is that what's added. I mean, in the case of some of these, what they do is they throw in tiny amounts of various herbs, claiming that, for example, for men, these will help fight off prostate cancer. And I think that that's a problem because there's some A, no evidence often these herbs do anything, and B, the amounts are usually so tiny that even if they were effective, the amounts are too small to really make a difference. And so it often boils down to a marketing gimmick.
Okay. One last thing I'll ask you this afternoon, and I think that this would be really a great public service. We only have a minute left here, but you have several pages in the book devoted to how we assess the science, and maybe here to wrap up this afternoon as part of this program that I think has been a great public service, that you'll give us a couple of the ideas that you share with readers in terms of assessing the science.
Sure. Well, some of the things I talk about is, number one is to look at what kind of study it is. I mean, again, you don't have to be a researcher or a doctor to figure this out. We know that if it's a clinical trial, one in which people were randomized to get either the treatment or a placebo, and they were followed for many years, and there were thousands of people, that's the gold standard. And when there are studies like that, we can be most certain that the evidence is credible. And so we have everything from that at one extreme to animal studies at the other, or test tube studies in terms of their relevance. So I think it's important to look at the kind of study and to know that not all research is created equal. Just because a study shows something to be true, we need to go beyond that and say what kind of study. That's one thing that's important. We need to look at who funded the research. You know, if a drug company funded it, or if a supplement company funded research on a supplement, we need to take that into account. Now, it doesn't invalidate the research necessarily, but it's something we need to keep in mind as we're looking at the evidence. Research conducted, for example, by the National Institutes of Health, the National Cancer Institute, is research that tends to be free of those kinds of concerns in terms of having influence on the research.
Yeah, there we've got to wrap up. We're out of time. Robert Davis, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Davis is an award-winning health journalist. He also holds a Ph.D. in health policy from Brandeis. He teaches at Emory University's Rollins School of Public Health. He is the author of The Healthy Skeptic, Cutting Through the Hype About Your Health. The Healthy Skeptic is published by the University of California Press.